You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
In China, it is known as the Lianghui. This week, more than 5,000 delegates will converge on Beijing for the two biggest political meetings of the year. But this year, there are historical, economic, and global factors that make these meetings even more important for the Beijing central government, for China, and for the world. Welcome to Inside China. My name is Mimi Lau. Before we get to find out more about why this year's meetings are so important, let me explain to you the difference between the two sessions, even though they happen at the same time. First, there is this meeting of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference, as known as the CPPCC. This starts first and is China's top political advisory committee. It's a bit like the House of Lords in Britain or the Senate in countries like the US and Australia. Its role is to advise the government on policies, and it's made up of 2,200 representatives from political parties, social sectors, professions, and other organizations. The CPPCC meeting takes around 2 weeks to conclude, and delegates discuss all kinds of issues from economics to health, foreign affairs, sports and religions. And the various committees make proposals for the government to consider. This is the closest Chinese people get to having a say in their country's affairs. But it has no lawmaking power. That authority belongs to the other of the two sessions, the National People's Congress, or the NPC. This is the meeting you will most likely see on television news reports in the West. The NPC has its annual meeting in the Great Hall of the People in Beijing. There are about 3,000 delegates, making it the largest parliamentary body in the world. NPC deputies are elected from the provinces, autonomous regions, and municipalities across mainland China, as well as the special administrative regions of Hong Kong and Macau. The NPC agenda is set months in advance, but it is also one of the few times in the year that the media have an opportunity to ask questions directly to government officials. But of course, those questions have to be submitted, screened, and approved in advance. So now you know how the two sessions were. Here is one of my colleagues from the South China Morning Post Bureau in Beijing, who will be reporting on this year's Lianghui. Mai Jun, whom we've spoken to last year, is going to bring us an update of what's going to happen. Mai Jun, for those listening in from the United States, from Germany and Australia, they will be seeing President Xi Jinping appearing on their TV screens as the world media reports on this year's two sessions. What role does Xi Jinping actually play in these meetings?
His actual role in the two sessions meetings are not legally important as we thought it would be, because Xi Jinping is the president of China, and according to the Chinese constitution, that role itself does not have that much power. For instance, the premier would be responsible for delivering the annual government report, and the cabinet, which is the state council, also headed by the premier, would be responsible for handing out, say, the five-year plan and other government documents and budgeting plans for the national legislation to be passed. But we should all bear very well in mind that she is the strongest leader in China for decades. So basically, everything that will be passed, everything that will be discussed, will mostly be determined by what Xi Jinping himself thinks are important.
So last year, you told us journalists covering the two sessions were forced to sit in another building to watch proceedings via video screen and do interviews online. How about this year? What kind of control or arrangement are you expecting this year for the media?
We know that, you know, Beijing's official line is we have already conquered the pandemic, and, you know, China is turning a victorious page on the pandemic. But in fact, we're expecting very much the same arrangements for this year's two sessions. We were told by the organizers that most of the interviews and most of the events will take place online, but I guess that maybe a very small number among the members of the press will be allowed to the actual building for each event. And I understand that a lot of domestic journalists who work for Chinese media have already been vaccinated. I still believe that, you know, the disease control will be very strict. And we also learned that all the diplomats who are interested in attending any one of these events should, you know, they should still take a COVID test and spend a night in a designated hotel to quarantine themselves and, you know, go to the actual event the other morning. So we believe that, you know, the in-person attendance are still very strictly restricted.
In previous episodes of Inside China podcast, we have heard how Beijing has tried to portray its control of the pandemic as a victory for its policies and its style of government. What kind of focus will there be on China's response to the pandemic in this year's two sessions?
We expect to see maybe any discussion about the pandemic only as a victorious. The pandemic will only be described as another obstacle that the party has led the people to overcome. I don't expect that there will be too much discussion about the disease control itself, but a lot of the policy direction, for instance, when they talk about the export and import, when they talk about new policies to improve China's health system, what happened in the last year would be, bear in mind, a lot of those issues that we saw from the last year during the disease control in China will be brought into the discussion of all these policies. They would not necessarily put a lot of focus on the pandemic itself, but the issues brought up by the pandemic will still be very dominant and will be looming over a lot of policy areas.
This year's two session is relatively special because 2021 is also the 100-year anniversary of the formation of the Chinese Communist Party. We know Beijing takes its historical moments very seriously. How is this going to influence the theme of this year's two sessions?
I think, to put it simply, the commemorations of the 100th anniversary of the foundation of the CCP will be the most important political task of the entire Chinese government and the entire party. But I think some aspects of the celebrations and, you know, and some, say, measures to keep the society stable, to get rid of so-called political instability risks, will be seen in the annual government report in the next year's plan. But the CCP, it's a Leninist party, and it places a heavy focus on history, and history is seen as a tool, an ideological tool to rally support for the domestic public, as well as to, you know, to keep all members of the Communist Party loyal. It is actually a tradition from the revolutionary days. There are actually two important resolutions on history by the CCP since its foundation. The first one is in the 1940s. That was when the CCP firmly established Mao Zedong as its supreme leader. And the second one was after the death of Mao Zedong. And, you know, Deng Xiaoping led all the Chinese officials to pass another resolution on his history so that China could turn a page on Mao's legacies and, you know, kick off its long-needed market reforms. So history itself is actually used as a political tool to direct and to actually justify current policies. So this is how important it is. And plus, in next year, Beijing will hold the 20th Party Congress, which is the five-yearly power transition of the Communist Party. So I do look at this celebration of the 100th anniversary of the CCP as part of the preparation for the Party Congress next year.
So if this is an historic moment in the history of the CCP, are there any indications Xi Jinping will be making a special announcement to mark the occasion?
The short answer is we don't know because, for instance, already during the Constitution Amendment in 2018, he already became the first state leader who has put its name inside China's constitution while he was still alive. He was already the first state leader to do this. So we don't know what else he's capable of. Like I just mentioned before, party history for the CCP is always used as a political tool to rally support for current policies. So it will be no surprise that, you know, it will be another venue used to further escalate Xi's personal status, but we don't know any details about it so far.
So this meeting also marks the beginning of the cycle of the five-year plan. Now, this process started back in April last year. Can you please unpack it for us? What do you know about it? About the kinds of things that will be announced and that we could expect in this year's two sessions from that five-year plan?
So basically, the five-year plan is a very comprehensive policy blueprint that includes almost anything, any policy you could think of. It will include specific growth target. At least the past five-year plans did. We're not sure whether a specific growth target would still be in this year's five-year plan. And there will be, specific targets, say, in terms of, say, investment in research and development, in terms of, specific targets in, for instance, new energy development and job creation and social welfare. So certain targets, for instance, the last five-year plan talked about, how it should improve its market reform, its fiscal policies, financial reform. So basically, anything you could think of, there will be a rough framework about it.
Back in 2015, we reported on the Made in China 2025 policy, but it seems that the initiative quietly disappeared from public mentions. What are the forecasts for technology policy for China?
I think Xi has made it very clear last year when the party was ramping up the preparations for the five-year plan that technology innovation would be among the most important tasks in the next 5 years plan. We do, we all remember how Made in China 2025 ended up. It was included in the last five-year plan, but was quietly dropped in all government papers 2 or 3 years later because it caused a great backlash from Washington. So that's why I think when China gets down to maybe a plan on its technology innovation this time, China might be less specific about its targets, but the real implementation would be very serious because, for instance, after what happened in under the Trump administration, after what happened to Huawei, what happened to WeChat and TikTok, it became very obvious to state leaders in China as well as decision makers in Washington that unless China could solve this issue of homegrown chips and homegrown high-tech products. Unless it could solve that problem, there's no way that China could get rid of the uncertainties in its supply chain. I think the understanding is, no matter what China said this time, made in China 2025 or not, China would pour in a lot of resources in solving this problem.
It's not just a five-year plan Beijing will be unveiling. There's also another plan being announced. It's called the 2035 Vision. Can you explain that for us?
That's a great question. I think, first of all, I think China has made 10-year plans before in the 90s and even further back. So this is not entirely a brand new invention. It's just something that China stopped introducing maybe in the last two decades. But as we can see, this kind of a longer term vision is also could also look familiar to us if we look at other places of the world. For instance, Saudi Arabia has its 2030 vision, if I'm correct, and Turkey has its 2023 vision. So basically, Xi Jinping's Vision 2035 would be something of a midterm or longer term strategic planning, and it would be more abstract. It would have even fewer specific targets, but it laid down the general policy directions for the next 15 years.
Externally, there is a lot of focus on China's technology and military budget, but internally, one of the biggest challenges has been how Beijing is dealing with rising economic inequality. What kind of policies might we see focusing on the gap between the rich and poor?
I think this is a huge issue. This is also an important issue that I think the current administration of China is paying more attention than the previous administrations. So one of the things that she poured a lot of resources into doing is on this poverty alleviation programs, for which the Beijing already declared victory. Whether it is completely effective, whether it is a accurate statement that poverty was terminated inside all of China, that's another issue. But a lot of resources were indeed put into this area. And I think also for the past 20 years, state leaders in China, they put more focus on, you know, driving the growth of it, the economy itself. So one of Deng Xiaoping's very famous saying is to let some people get rich first. So I think that sort of vision was no longer being talked about right now. What Xi Jinping seems to be focusing a lot right now is trying to like economic growth more evenly distributed among the less well-off groups of people. But it will be an insanely difficult effort considering the sheer population size of China and the huge difference between urban and rural areas. And it is also something that's very difficult to accurately assess if we want to talk about how successful it is.
What are your sources in Beijing telling you about the changes to policy in response to Joe Biden's administrations in the United States? Will there be moves to reposition Beijing's relationship with Washington?
I think over the past few years, Beijing has come to realize that, even though the deterioration of U.S.-China's ties took place under the Trump administration, but a lot of these structural problems would still remain and will be carried into the Biden administration. But it seems like Beijing's tactics right now, at least in the open, in the public sphere, is to act like all the instability of the bilateral ties were caused by the mistakes made by Trump. Whether that would be effective, it's another question, of course. But I think Beijing would at least show more efforts into areas where Washington might need Beijing's cooperation on. For instance, climate change, for instance, non-proliferation North Korea and other international issues. But I think in general, I think the Chinese government is still pretty sober-minded about the prospect of U.S.-China relations, that there would not be any fundamental improvement of the bilateral ties, and a lot of the issues that Washington, as well as leaders in Europe, were very concerned about, including in Xinjiang, including these assertive policies in Hong Kong. These issues are considered core interest by Beijing, and Beijing has shown, you know, has shown no willingness to compromise on these issues. But it seems like what they want to do right now is to play up the areas where cooperation could take place.
Mai Jun, you are in Beijing, and each year we normally see a massive security presence on the streets of Beijing in the lead up to the two sessions. Are you seeing anything like that right now?
Well, to be honest, I think security was actually, I don't know, I do not see that much extra security right now on the street. I think basically maybe people are still getting back to the office from Spring Festival. And I think the disease control measures were actually more strict a month ago when the outbreak of Hebei just took place. But right now, it seems like that outbreak was over, and, you know, all the extra disease control are again being tuned down. So we're actually seeing a more normal Beijing at the moment. But of course, the two sessions will always be a politically sensitive period for Beijing, and a lot of extra security measures might take place in places where we don't see, for instance, on our social media software or on the surveillance cameras on the street. So we don't know.
You will no doubt be very busy over the next week or two. Mai Jun, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
You can, of course, see all of Mai Jun's reporting and news analysis, as well as the work from all of us on China Desk at the South China Morning Post website, scmp.com. That's all we have for you this week for Inside China. My name is Mimi Lau. Take care. Bye for now.
As critical news stories emerging from China continue to shape lives and business around the world, the weekly SCMP Global Impact Newsletter brings you expert analyses and insights on the economics of COVID-19, society, technology, and the environment. Sign up to receive your weekly email at scmp.com/newsletters.